So we are in Perek Aleph of Yeshaya. Last week we did a quick look at the chapter in terms of some of the poetry and the language. What I want to do this week is complete our look at the chapter by looking at particular images and messages that he has here. As I said in the beginning, and I stress this because I know it's going to disappoint some people, we're not going to look at every possible question you could ask, every possible message you can find, every choice of words. So when I say any questions on a set of psukim, I'm glad for people to throw out questions. We're not going to necessarily deal with all of them because, again, this is a really big book. So I want to call your attention. It's on page 955 if you're using the Stone Tanakh. I want to call your attention to Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Still in chapter 1. Haven't gone anywhere. And the image of calling heaven and earth as witnesses. Shim'u shamayim v'hazini eretz. Listen up, heavens. Lend an ear, earth. Right? How do they do it here? Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. The earth is Irish, O earth. So I find this to be fascinating on a few different levels. First of all, he uses these terms, ha'azinu and shim'u, twice within the chapter, meaning he uses it here in sentence 2, and then he uses it again in sentence 10. He says, Shim'u dvar Hashem kitzinei Sidom ha'azinu tarat Elokeinu am amora. Listen to the word of God, officers of Sidom. Lend an ear to the teaching of our God, nation of Amora. I find that interesting without any point. He's not paralleling heaven and earth and Sidom and Amora. But it's funny to see this turn of phrase used for both. These two verbs are used elsewhere in Tanakh, right? The most clear example in the beginning of Parshat Ha'azinu. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim ha'adabera v'tishma ha'aretz imrei fi. Lend an ear. Lend an ear, heavens, and I will speak, and the land will listen to the words of my mouth. That's Devarim chapter 32. But here's the question for you. What's the difference between Shmi'a and Ha'azana? Why do you have two different verbs? Yeah.
Ha'azinu means pay attention, and Shmi'u just means hear.
Says who? I'm not disagreeing, but what's the basis for assigning these two verbs, those terms?
Because one is requiring focused listening, and one is just your hear.
But on what basis? Why should Ha'azin be more focused than Lishma?
Like you say, folks, listen up.
Because it's Ozen. And why should Ozen indicate greater attention? But so does Lishma.
How do you feel like you have to make an effort to do something?
So there's a possibility, I think. Janine points out, Lishma is almost passive. Here you are, and the words are entering you, and you absorb them. Whereas Laha'azin has an indication of you have to do something. Like in English, we say lend an ear. It sounds more active. So that's an argument you could give that way. On the other end, I could give an argument the other way and say Lishmoa is often used in Tanakh not to refer to simply absorbing information, but to acceding to it. Acceding, A-C-C-E-D. Right? To go along with it. To obey instructions. So, right? The one who will not who won't listen, but who won't listen, the way we use it in English. The one who won't go along with it. So you can go either way. Yeah.
There's also Naseh
v'nishma. Precisely. That's an example, clearly, that doesn't just mean we're going to hear the words. It means we're going to hear and obey. Exactly. Ralph.
Well, and when you
seems
say
to me that Ha'azan is a physical act, and Shemoa is to understand.
Right.
It goes one step further.
Well, it could be it's to understand, but I'm going to ask you how you know that Lishmoa means to understand. I want to know, when we assign these definitions, what's our basis for doing so? Sorry, it was Dahl, you were going to say?
No, I was just thinking when you say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, it's a whole other meaning of Shema.
I think so. I think you're right.
You're
you're, it's almost like commanding God to listen.
Right.
Commanding Israel to listen.
Right. What makes this particularly perplexing, if I can play Yeshaya and say particularly perplexing, while you keep your hand on 955, flip, please, to Devarim chapter 32, sentence 1, which is the pasuk I referenced before. It's at page 505. So you're at 955 and 505. Many of you are familiar with this in any case, but we'll look at it inside. You see that? Tell me, which verb is associated with the heavens in Devarim? Leha'azin. Right? Leha'azin is the one. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim. Which one does Yeshaya associate with the heavens? Shim'u. When Moshe speaks in Ha'azinu, it's Ha'azinu ha'shamayim v'tishma ha'aretz. Whereas when Yeshaya speaks, it's the opposite. It's Shim'u shamayim v'ha'azini eretz. Now, if you want, you could ignore the last 5 minutes and simply say that these are just two words for listening and they're being poetic and don't get hung up on it and fine. But that's not my school of thought. Take a look at source number one. The Midrash in the Sifri. Most of Sifri is halachic Midrash, but not all, as you're going to see right here. The Sifri, which is Midrash to the Book of Dvarim, and it's very old, it's among the oldest canonized bodies of Midrash, offers multiple explanations for what's going on. Number one, here, why is it he uses two verbs? And number two, why he's different from Moshe? I'm only bringing you a couple of the explanations that he brings. That the Sifri brings, I should say. Take a look at number one. Davar acher, alternatively, because, again, there were preceding explanations brought. Ha'azinu ha'shamayim, lefi shehaya Moshe karov la'shamayim. Moshe was near the heavens. Lefichach amar ha'azinu ha'shamayim. So he said, ha'azinu ha'shamayim. Ulefi shehaya rachok min ha'aretz, and he was far from the earth, amar v'tishma ha'aretz imrei fi. So he said, the earth will listen. In other words, la'ha'azin somehow indicates proximity. Lishmoa is more distant, he says. That's the idea. Whereas by Yeshaya, along comes Yeshaya, who does not have Moshe's celestial character. And he said, no. Shim'u shamayim, shmi'ah for the heavens, shurachok min hashamayim, because he was far from the heavens. I didn't translate the word samach in my translation because I'm not really sure what that word is doing here. I thought of a couple of ways to say it, and maybe samach ledaber. I wasn't sure, so and it didn't change the meaning of the overall midrash, so I simply left it transliterated. But it's in number one on this week's sheet. That's one explanation, is that it's actually, there is a substantive difference between Moshe and Yeshaya, and these choices of words reflect that. And according to this approach, leha'azin is a word you say to somebody who's close. I'm speaking into your ear. Lishmoa is what you say to somebody who's far away. Like, pay attention from afar type of a thing. I thought that was interesting. Gita, just hold off while I do the second explanation. V'chachamim omrim. The chachamim said, ein adavar kein. That's not it. Ela bizman sheba'im ha'edim. This is fascinating. It says, when witnesses come to testify in court, and they testify, if their words are found to match, meaning what they say is the same, we saw from this place, at this angle, that this happened, then their testimony is upheld. But if not, their testimony is not upheld. So, he says, look, I'm going to say it outside of the text, but Moshe said, if Moshe had just said Ha'azinu Hashamayim, and that would have been it, then the heavens would say that's the only way we heard it was with this form of Leha'azin. And he says, V'tishma ha'aretz, so the land will say, we only heard it with Shmi'ah. Well, those are two different experiences. My two witnesses, heaven and earth, are using two different terms. So Yeshaya says, I'm going to complete the set. I'm going to use Shmi'ah for the heavens, Ha'azanah for the earth, and that way each of them has both experiences, the experience of Shmi'ah and Ha'azanah, and therefore their testimony can be upheld as a single set. And clearly there's no issue here of them actually showing up in court. I mean, that's not really the point. The idea here, what I think is being expressed here, is that the idea really is we are calling on the heavens and the earth to experience and to see what human beings are doing and what the Jews, because they're the ones being spoken to, are doing. And we're saying that they are both serving as complete witnesses to what you do. Nothing is being missed. The heavens and the earth are both seeing everything that happens. Ralph?
Is there an order of importance?
I'm sorry. Is there an order of importance?
Shouldn't the earth come before the heavens?
Why?
Because the earth is closer.
Closer to us, the ones who are being observed. It's interesting. On the other hand, you could argue that the heavens are God's domain, so to speak, and therefore they're associated with God. See, one of the questions you have to ask as you go through this, and I've been sort of not addressing it, well, not sort of, I have not been addressing it, is the question of what heavens means here. Does Shamayim here mean the sky, in which case it's no more God's domain than the earth is, or does Shamayim here mean God's realm where the angels are? In which case I would certainly understand putting Shamayim first. But really from the beginning of the Torah we say Eit HaShamayim Ve'et HaAretz. We've been very comfortable with the idea that Shamayim precedes Aretz in sentences. It's rare, you do have one case that I can think of in the beginning of the Chumash, which is B'yom Baro Elokim Eretz V'Shamayim. But generally speaking, it's Shamayim and then Eretz. Gita, you were going to say...
We don't know who's being addressed.
What do you mean?
Who is Isaiah talking to?
The Jews, no? You mean when he says, listen up?
This whole verse.
So the real audience is the Jews. And he's using heaven and earth for an image that we're going to get to shortly. Yes?
Yeah, since Yeshayahu, among his other talents, is a poet, it would seem to me that, in terms of alliteration, Shimu Shamayim V'Hazinu Eretz, they're both pins and olives.
Right, it's true. You can't skip the alliteration.
Yeah.
You are correct. The alliteration is a valid point, so let's put that one in our list also. Okay. But, Jeanette.
I just took the word Samach, at least in the second point, just that Yeshayahu completed the process, because it's only half the process. Because it wasn't, that they weren't valid testimony because they used different types of hearing. And Yeshayahu added this to make it a complete process. You know, total witness.
I hear you.
I'm not sure about the first one.
Yeah, no, I'm not either, and I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that because it's in both. I think it's an artifact of speech. That's what I'm guessing, and I'm just not familiar enough. But what's more interesting here than the question of why use these verbs is what Ralph is asking, which is what's the image here? What is he trying to tell the Jews when he says, I want heaven and earth to be your witnesses? What's he getting at?
Yeah, this is for Landville.
Right. So let me, before we get to that point that Ora makes, because I think that's an important point, is the eternal nature of heaven and earth, or quasi-eternal anyway, because they're created. But first you have to recognize heaven and earth partner a lot in Tanakh. Obviously, in the very beginning, they're created together, but you find it throughout Tanakh that they appear, Shemayim and Eretz are paired together, and specifically they serve as witnesses, not just Ha'azinu Hashemayim V'Adaber V'Tishma Ha'aretz Imrei Fi, which I mentioned from Parshat Ha'azinu, but look at source number 2, I gave you other references. Dvarim, chapter 4, sentence 26, Moshe turns to the Jews and he says, Ha'idoti Bachem, I think that's the one I'm referring to there. Let's actually go back and take a look rather than guess. I think it's Ha'idoti Bachem Ayom V'Tishmaim V'Taharetz, but that may be the second one that I referenced. It is the first one. Okay, good. Page 439.
24:26?
Yes. 426. You have it on your sheet, number 2. Yep. So there, he says, "Ha'idoti v'achem hayom et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz ki avot tovedun maher." Moshe tells the Jews, "I am making heaven and earth witnesses today to say you are going to be destroyed." He says that you're going to be destroyed, and he calls heaven and earth as witnesses to this covenant. And then again in chapter 30, so jumping to page 503, no, page 501, sorry. Sentence 19, again, it's in the same in both. That's why I couldn't remember which one it is. Ha'idoti v'achem hayom et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. He says, "I call as witnesses upon you today, heaven and earth. Hachayim v'amavet natati lefanecha brachah v'haklala. I give you the choice, life and death, blessing and curse," and so on. So they are partnered a lot in Tanakh, and they are witnesses in particular. So the question is, what is it that they represent? So one way to take it is, as Ora says, it is the fact that they are enduring. They were there in the beginning. They were the first entities God created, in fact. And they endure. They last, right? If you think of the beginning of Kohelet, right? Dor holech v'dor baba aretz le'olam amadet v'zarach ha-shemesh u'va ha-shemesh. Right? The generations come and go. The earth is here. The sun rises. The sun sets. So they last longer than we do. In fact, Yeshaya in chapter 66 is going to describe God renewing them in the future. The Shamayim HaChadashim and the Aretz HaChadasha. So you could look at it that way and simply say they endure. They're the beginning. They're there at the end. And therefore, he's going to call them to be witnesses. But I want to know, what does it mean for them to be witnesses? They're not testifying in court. Right? So what does that mean when you say they are witnesses? Yeah.
They were there, and I wanted to say that in Bereshit, heaven and earth are the witnesses to God's creation, okay? In certain ways.
Yeah.
And maybe that idea is continued, I don't know.
But what does it mean? In practice, what does it mean? Meaning, let's say I wanted to make a deal with somebody. I wanted to make a business deal. Okay? And we were standing out in a field. And I said to him, "You see those trees? Those trees are witnesses." Okay. So what? What does this mean? It's a nice poetic image, but where does it take you? What is Yeshaya trying to do? So I brought you a long piece here. It's not that long a piece. It felt long when I was translating it. In source number 3 from that same Sifri, where you get multiple explanations of what this is. And it's more than just being held up as, look, isn't it neat? There are heavens and earth. We can call them witnesses. It's meant to convey a message about God and God's involvement. And I think that's really what it's about. The heavens and the earth are a lesson in dealing with the God who has made this covenant. So take a look. Davar acher, alternatively. Ha'azinu ha-shamayim. Mashal ha-melech shamasaret b'no le-pedagog. He says, you can compare this to a case where the king gives his son to a tutor. Le'yon yoshevu m'shamro, and the tutor's job is to sit and watch him. Amaro to aben. So the kid says, "Kesavur Abba Shahoil Klum Shemesarani Le Pedagog." What? My father thinks he's actually accomplished something by giving me to the tutor. You think he's going to watch me? Achshav Harini Mishamro. I am going to watch him. Kadesh Yochal VeYishtev VeYashen. And I'm going to watch and see when he eats, when he drinks, when he goes to sleep. VeElechani VeSet Zrachayim. When he goes to sleep, or when he goes to eat, I'm going to go do whatever I want to do. Right? Like kids from time immemorial. They'll find the weak spot. Amar lo aviv, his father says to him, "Afani lo mesarticha lepedagog ela shelo yehei mazizcha." He says, no. I gave him to a tutor so that he would not leave you. The grammar in mazizcha is a little bit odd, but that's what it means. Kach amar lo Moshe Yisrael. So Moshe says to the Jews, "Shema atem svirim livroach mitachat kanfei shechina o lazuz me'al haaretz." What, you think you're going to get out from under the heavens? You think you're going to get off of this planet? Now, of course, you know, that's a thing now. You can get off of this planet. But the idea here and the image that Moshe is giving to the Jews, that Yeshaya in our section is giving to the Jews, is that God is inescapable. and the covenant to which they bear witness is all-encompassing. Lots of luck trying to get out from under it. That's the first explanation here. Recognizing that time is flying, and I don't like minimizing having people speak, so I'm going to tell you outside what the rest of this midrash does in order for us to be able to move along. The second approach that I brought you here, the second Devar Acher, is that the heavens and the earth themselves are role models for how we are supposed to function, in the sense that they are consistent and thanklessly so, meaning nobody comments on the fact that they just do what they're supposed to do. The heavens do what they're supposed to do. The sun rises, the moon rises, and so on, and they never cease to do what they're supposed to do. I actually find it funny because one of the things he mentions in terms of the consistency is that the earth always brings forth whatever you plant. Number one, he never saw my garden. But number two, what about the whole curse of Adam? Right. Nonetheless, that's what this Midrash says. It says the heavens do. I guess that was what it was supposed to do. That was when God told it to do something different, so it did something different. But that's the second approach. Again, it's using them as role models for us. The third approach is a little bit different. It is that they are the instruments of reward and punishment for us. He's not simply saying they are witnesses. They are the tools of reward and punishment. And we find that repeatedly in the Torah, that God predicts, he says, if you sin, then the heavens will be like iron and the land will be like copper below. Right? As opposed to, if you do the mitzvot, I will give you the rain at the proper time. Right? There are all sorts of applications of this. The last one that I brought here, I found as my favorite, and that is because they are part of the mitzvot. The heavens and the earth are not distant. They're not remote. We have mitzvot of the heavens. We use the sun, the moon, the stars to calculate all our celebrations. And we have mitzvot of the land, clearly, right? All the mitzvot which relate to the harvest. So therefore, they're not simply distant witnesses, but he's saying, Shimu shamayim vazini eretz, right? Listen up, heavens, lend an ear, earth, who are part of these mitzvot the Jews should have been doing, which they did not do. So that's the image that I see here.
This is what God promised.
Yeah.
That heaven and earth would respond to our actions.
Also, Joe, you're going back to the idea that they're an instrument of the reward and punishment. Yeah. So, yeah. You know what? I'm going to go further. I'm going to go further at this point because there's so much to talk about. I really want to stick to the pace.
Fair to ask.
I thought I said
about the difference in the grammatical form of the two verbs.
What do you mean?
One is Shimu and one is Haz.
Right, so that was what Janine had pointed out.
Be exactly the same.
Right, and they're not.
The English misleads you.
Yeah, but
yes.
Lying is plural.
You can hang that up on a sign, the English misleads you. It'll be true. No, that was Janine's point when I asked in the beginning what the difference is between these two verbs and what they might mean, is that Shimi'ah is a simple verb and Lahazin requires an action. You have to do something. You feel... Yeah, it's much stronger. It sounds much stronger.
One is active and one is passive.
But it's not really passive and active, but one is more mild and one is more forceful. And now I really am going to go further. The other thing I want to call your attention to, just on small points, there are a couple of small points to see before we talk about some of the major issues in this chapter, is in sentences 10 to 15, so we're back again in Yeshaya chapter 1, page 955. If you look at that passage, right, Shimu Dvar Hashem Kitzinei Sidom, where he calls us the officers of Sidom, the nation of Amorah, and he says, Lama li rov zivchechem, what do I want with all of your offerings that you bring? I am full of the burnt offerings of the rams. I am full of the fat that you brought from these animals. You come to see me. I don't want you. I don't want you trampling in my in my courtyard. I mean, he is so strong, the passion of rejection here. The only parallel I can think of is in Eicha chapter 3 when we're told, Satam tefilati, God sealed off my prayer. He said, I'm not interested in hearing your prayer at all. This is an incredibly painful thing. When God says, I'm not interested anymore, and I brought you the Gemara in Chagiga in source number 4, Rav Huna kimati lahai kra. When Rav Huna got to this pasuk, he would cry. What was the pasuk? Yeh ra'eh in the Torah is the verb that's used, shall be seen, to refer to those who go to the temple, those who go to the Beit HaMikdash for the festivals, for Shalosh Regalim, for the holidays. Yeh ra'eh kal zechurcha, to be seen. And here, he says, I don't want you to be seen in my courtyard. So Rav Huna would cry at that contrast where he wants us to be seen. Now he says he doesn't want us to be seen. Omar, he said, if the slave's master anticipates seeing him, now he's going to be distanced from him. It's a reversal of the relationship between God and his nation. And it should be an extremely painful thing. Rav Soloveitchik used to say that that's the reason for not saying Tachanun on Tisha B'Av. There are a couple of practices on Tisha B'Av which could be understood to indicate this level of distance. One is the omission of Tachanun. Another one is that in some communities they stop saying, or they don't say the line of Titkabel in Kaddish Shalem, in the full Kaddish. The line of Titkabel says, Titkabel Tzlotonu Vohotonu Dechol Beit Yisrael, that all the prayers of the house of Israel should be accepted. And one idea in omitting that line is to say that on Tisha B'Av they're not accepted. Similarly, the Torah reading on Tisha B'Av in the morning is not the standard reading for a fast day, which invokes the 13 attributes of divine mercy. Instead, it's this chapter of rebuke from the book of Devarim. We actually saw a verse from it earlier. The image here is of God saying, "I am not at all interested." Which is obviously an extremely painful thing. And the height of the pain, I think, is the last sentence in this chapter. If you take a look at the end of the chapter, sentence 31. V'haya hechason lina'oret. The one who had been mighty will be like flax. Ufo'alo linitzotz. That which he had made, or they render it as its maker, okay, will be like a spark. Uvarush nehem yachdav ve'ein mechabeh. They will burn together, and ein mechabeh. No one will extinguish it. That's the end of not just the chapter, but the end of the section. I mean, the new section is a brand new thought. Hadavar asher chaza. It's a brand new thought. That kind of ending is something we find that I can think of two other places in Tanakh, and it's never good. The tochacha, the warning of rebuke, the warning of future punishment found in Parshat Ki Tavo. If you take a look... if you take a look on page 497, you see that? Page 497, it's sentence 69, sentence 68, I should say. The end of a very long section of suffering that will befall the Jews if they leave the covenant with God. It ends with, Vitmakartem sham lo yevecha, you will be sold there to your enemies in exile. Lavadim v'lishpacho, to be slaves. Vein koneh. And no one is even going to want to buy. Like this, vein mechabeh. You burn, and there's nothing to put it out. And then the third place that I could think of, there may be others, is in Yirmiyahu. If you jump ahead now, you want Yirmiyahu chapter 9, sentence 21. It is page 1095. You see that? Sentence, chapter 9, sentence 21. Is that what I said? Or did I say something else? Okay. It's page 1095. So, here again, you find this lament that's being offered. And he says, V'nafla nivlat ha'adam kidomen al pnei ha'sadeh, the corpse of the person will fall like excrement on the field, u'cha'amir me'acharei ha'kotzer, like the sheep that the harvester drops, v'ein me'aseif, and nobody will gather it in. And again, the end. It's like there's no hope after that. It's simply, you're done. It's very strong. And that's what I meant when I said to you that this chapter is such a harsh and horrific chapter to read. I can't think of another chapter in Tanakh that's as bad as this. This is just so painful as a message. Susan?
I just want a word, because here they explain, I'm not even sure which word, as the strong shall be as tow, T-O-W. And I
right.
don't understand.
It means flax.
Oh, tow is another word for flax?
Yeah. It's some kind of easily burned plant. Whether it's the same or not, I can't say for sure.
Okay,
but we usually associate Na'oret with Pishtan, which is clearly flax.
Yeah.
So yeah. I don't know. It could be a type of product of flax, like an aspect of the plant that I don't know. Okay. So those are just some smaller points within the chapter. But let's ask a big question here. We already alluded to this a little bit last week. When did this prophecy take place? Is this really Yeshaya's first message to the people? Wouldn't that be great? You're a prophet, you go out in the marketplace and you say this? Is anyone going to listen to you ever again?
It can't be. It's like watching a play and they start in the middle and they go to the beginning. It can't be. Time's been good for the Jews then.
Exactly.
Was,
so,
you know, so,
right.
So this is, just think of it as a literary construct.
Right. So this is the question here. But it's not just a technical question. I want to be clear. This is not just a technical question of chronology. It's a substantive question because we're asking, is he beginning his career with a horrific rebuke to a suffering population, which is what this sounds like? Or is it really what we're going to see in chapters 2 to 5, which is what Debbie is alluding to, where he's going to speak to a wealthy population, which is what we believe was around in the beginning of his career, and he is rebuking them and providing a vision of the time of Mashiach? Is that the beginning of his career? Or is it chapter 6, in which he envisions God's throne room, and he has a vision that punishment is coming, Bishnat Mot HaMelech Uzziyahu, in the year of the death of King Uzziyahu? That's your Haftarah. There you go.
Chapter 2 is totally elevating.
Yeah, isn't it? 2 is wonderful. We could have just started with 2, right?
But
we didn't need 1.
It refers to the end
it's
of
like
days.
Shakespeare, though.
Not a historical.
So, but that's what we have to ask, yes?
It's on a lighter vein.
Don't think anything light. We're in chapter 1.
Anybody who knows the Jewish curses.
Yes.
From Yeshayahu without.
Yes, this is true. So the simple read is that chapter 1 is the start, and he opens with a rebuke. That's, you know, usually when I open a book, I assume page 1 is what's happening first until you tell me otherwise. Buria.
But couldn't he be speaking to a time when things are really good and warn them of things to come? Like, in other words, is this chapter only...
So it's entirely possible.
Suffering? I mean, I would have thought that you could say somebody has it really good and say, hey, you know, there's this...
See, it's possible to do that.
Right.
The problem with that is go back to the chapter itself and ask yourself, is that what he sounds like he's saying? Meaning, he's not describing something and saying, this is going to happen. Look at sentence 5. Look at sentence 5 as an example. Where again, we're back on page 955. Al-mesukuod tosifu sara. Why have you been struck? Right? And yet you continue to rebel. Kol rosh lachali. Every head is aching, is ill, v'bnei tek choli. Kol levav davai. Every heart is grieving. Mikaf regel ve'ad rosh ein bo metom. From the bottom of one's foot to one's head, there is nothing complete. Petza v'chavura. There are wounds. He doesn't sound like he's seeing a future. He sounds like this is what's here. So that's one reason why most of the commentators assume this is not the beginning of his prophecy. This is plucked from later. Then we'll have to discuss why, but that's in a minute. But Abarbanel, in fact, suggests this chapter is from much later. Barbanel suggests that this chapter is actually drawn from after the Assyrians invade and destroy the northern kingdom. And that what Yeshaya is saying is, you see what happened over there? This could be you. That far forward in the future. That's one possibility is, yeah, chapter 1 is the beginning, but it's hard to support that read. Second possible read is that chapter 6 is in fact the beginning. Jump to chapter 6, sentence 8, please, and you'll see why. It's page 963 at the bottom. After Yeshaya describes how in the year of King Uzziah's death he has a vision of God's throne room, he is purified of his own personal impurity as described here in the text, and then he hears the voice of God. V'ashma eskol Hashem, I heard God's voice, Omer, saying, Esmi ishlach, umi yelech lanu, who should I send? Who will go on our behalf? And his response is, pick me, right? Vamar, hinini, shlacheni, unlike many other Nevi'im, who said, pick someone else. Yeshaya says, pick me, right? There's where your Moshe Yeshaya comparisons fall apart. But that supports the idea that chapter 6 is in fact when he's picked. As a Nevi, as a prophet, if you take a look on your sheets at source number 5, the Mechilta is halachic midrash usually on the book of Shemot. Bishnat Mod HaMelech Uzziah, in the year of Uzziah's death, Zeh Hayat Chilat HaParsha, that was the beginning of the book. When he says Parsha, he means that's the beginning of the book. V'lama Nechtav Kan, so why is it in chapter 6? L'fishein Mugdamu Mulchar B'Torah, because we don't really care about chronological order anyway. So we did it just to sort of in your face it, like, you know, in order to make sure really clear that there's no such thing as order, we're going to make it really clear by having him picked as a Navi in chapter 6. And after that, if you have any questions about order, we're just going to refer you back to here. This is hard to absorb. This is really hard to absorb, but that's the idea that is taking, and Rashi adopts that approach as well. Yes, Ralph? Nope? Okay. Right, so we haven't gotten to 2, 3, 4, and 5 yet. The problems here are the following. Number one, that means he starts to speak in the year of Uzziah's death. However, chapters 2 through 5 seem to be addressing a wealthy, expanding population like that of the time of King Uzziah. You could be it all in the last year. It's possible. But now it's even weirder then. Because that means you're doing 6, 2, 3, 4, 5, and at some point 1 happens. Like, it defies credulity to offer that as an idea. So some solve the problem by offering the following solution. They say that the year of the death of King Uzziah doesn't really mean the year of his death. Not as strange as it sounds. Not as strange as it sounds. Because we already saw in our introduction that Uzziah was struck with sarat, which is compared to death in many ways throughout the Torah. Think of the purification rituals of what the mitzvah does. But not only that, this is something that somebody mentioned, it was Moshe Wise, in our first week. Jump to Divrei Hayamim Bet, Chronicles 2. I gave it to you the reference in source number 8 on the sheet, so you can see it there. It's Chronicles 2, chapter 26, sentence 21. So you want to jump to the end of the book. Page 1995.
Chapter and verse again, please.
It's on your sheet. You see it. Source number 8. Source number 8.
Uzziah is king of Judah?
Uzziah, correct. Uzziah in the English, but Uzziah, yeah. That's correct. Also known as Azariah sometimes, for reasons that are beyond me. You see sentence 21? He was a leper, as they call it, even though, again, Sarat is not leprosy. Nonetheless, that's the way everybody's going to translate it. The Uzziah is a Mitzarat to the day of his death, and what does he do? He stays in this special house, this special space that, they call it asylum here. Okay, fine. That's actually not a bad translation, because in Hebrew it's Beit HaChoshit, right? To be free, asylum. Okay. Kinigzarmi Beit Hashem, because he was now cut off from the house of God. V'yotam bino al Beit HaMelech shofet Adam Haaretz, and his son Yotam takes over as king. He has regency. So that it makes sense to actually say, this is the year when he's dead for all intents and purposes. No one sees him again. He doesn't function as king. He has no connection anymore. Ora? He is considered as though he was dead. So that's a view here, is that the year of his death, so to speak, is not really the year of his death at all. So the Targum Yonatan takes that view. It's quoted in Radak. Targum Yonatan is considered to be the greatest and most authoritative Aramaic commentary to the prophets. It's supposed to be authored by Yonatan ben Uziel, who was a Tana, one of the authors of the Mishnah. Take a look at source number 6 where he brings the idea. Although the Radak personally is going to go a different direction with it. But the beginning of Radak, he says, Tirgem Yonatan, Yonatan translated, Bishata di'itnagaba malka Uziyahu. The year when Uziyahu was afflicted, meaning with Tzarat, V'ukish nechnas lak tir ketaret behechal, that was when he went into the temple and tried to bring the ketaret himself, V'hat Tzarat zarcha b'mitzchau, and the Tzarat burned on his forehead. And then Radak's going to give you his own idea after that. We're going to come back to his own idea. But we have this idea elsewhere. Jump to source number 7, please. Midrash in Shmot Rabbah. Vayamat Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, died. This midrash is dealing with a problem. The problem that this midrash is dealing with is that the sentence it's commenting on says that the Jews are slaves in Egypt, the king of Egypt died, and the Jews groaned from their labor. And that, on the face of it, doesn't make sense. The king of Egypt died. Their slave driver is dead. They should have been happy. So there are different explanations. One explanation is that they took the opportunity to pray. Now they said, now there's hope. He's dead. And their anacha, their groaning, was actually tefillah, davening. Another approach is to say that it was when the new king took over, who was even worse than the old king. But this midrash suggests that it's actually they were groaning because he wasn't dead. He had tzarat, and in order to cure his tzarat, he had the idea that he should use the blood of the Jewish children. That's what the midrash brings. So here you see, in source number 7, an excerpt from the midrash, Vayamad Melech Mitzrayim Shenitztara. He developed tzarat. Vamitzarah Hashuv Kemet, and the mitzarah is considered as one who is dead, and they give you as an example of it when Aaron says to Moshe to daven for Miriam, Al Natihi Kemet, don't let her be as one who is dead. And they bring our sentence, Bishnat Mot Hamelech Uziyahu. So they take this idea that that it's not that he's really dead, and in that case, the way you could read it is, chapter 6 really is the beginning, and then chapters 2 through 5, and then the rest of the book. Radak doesn't like it, Abarbanel doesn't like it, and they take the view that it's his death, that in fact is his death, and therefore Radak and Abarbanel are of the opinion that chapter 6 cannot be the beginning. Take a look at source number six again on your sheets. The second half of it. V'yesh lefaresh. One could explain. V'yesh lefaresh mitamamash. You could explain its actual death. It is the year of his death. Ulepeirush hazeh, within this view, lo yiyazeh tchilat nevuato, this is not the beginning of his prophecy. Umasha siper hashana shara zot hamared, then why did you tell me in the year of the death of King Uziyahu? It sounds like you're making the beginning. L'fisha b'moto hereyu ha'am. It's because that was when the nation began to sin, and therefore he started presenting his messages. So Radak and Abarbanel don't buy it. So right now we have two ideas. Again, let's make sure we understand what we're saying. One view is, chapter 1 is the beginning, and Yeshaya starts with rebuke. That's weak. Because again, he sounds like he's talking to people who are already suffering. It doesn't really fit. By the way, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention this, but I have it in my notes and I like it too much to skip it. This midrash that links Uziyahu with Paro is fascinating. Because they were both builders. And they were both arrogant. and they both didn't listen. So I wonder if that's not part of the subtext of this midrash, is that it's trying to make a connection between the Bishnat Mot of Uzziyahu and Vayamat of Melech Mitzrayim. I don't know. I wonder about that. But going back to where we were, the second idea was that chapter 6 is the beginning. But that's weird because that means that he starts to speak in the last year of Uzziyahu, unless you say that it's the tzaraat which you could offer. But it's not accepted by everyone. So your third approach is that chapters 2 through 5 are actually the beginning. Meaning, the book of Yeshaya should start with chapter 2. And then read from there. Abarbanel suggests that. That this is the read. Professor Yechezkel Kaufman is cited in the book by Rav Yoel Ben Nun, and I think he favors that view based on the book's structure. And that's his suggestion. But now let's ask the question of why all this matters. Okay? While it's interesting historically, what are we really getting at here? If the book really begins with chapter 6, or if the book really begins with chapter 2, why is chapter 1 in the beginning?
Dramatic effect.
Get your attention. And make sure you don't want to read chapter 2.
It lays out the problem.
Sorry?
Lays out the problem.
It
has to be dealt with.
Okay, you're right. Because the problems that he identifies there are the problems we're going to be confronted by the entire book. Which is to say, the pair of cruelty to other people and lack of faith in God. Those are the book's themes. So that could be it. He talks about, well, hypocrisy in terms of either religion or social relations. Yes, all right.
Maybe because Uzziyahu was a strong thing. He built that up. He built from the north to the south.
Yeah.
And it's like Ish-Yoshef Tahat Yachnov and Tahat Netzachor. They were so good. Their life was so good. So they did all the bad things.
Right.
So
why would you start?
So, and Yeshayahu was young at that time that Uzziyahu was sick. So he foresaw, he saw what was going on, that they were so bad. So then maybe that's when he's
Right. I hear you, but I have two problems. Problem number one is that this isn't what he said in Uzziyahu's time. In other words, within this view, this chapter was actually said later on when he was older and Uzziyahu was long gone. We're taking the view now that this is from later, not from what happened now. And again, he's actually, it sounds like, sentence 5, sentence 6, he's seeing it live. I think this may be because we read Tanakh wrong. Meaning, we always read Tanakh, I say we, me, okay? Everybody else is fine, they get it right. But my tendency when I read something in Tanakh is to read it as though it's being written down in the era when the event takes place. I read Shmuel, and I assume it's speaking to somebody from Shmuel's time, right? That's my assumption, because that's the way we read books. But when you're dealing with Tanakh, the decision to canonize it and to say this is in and this is out and this is here and this is the way it's going to be expressed and all of those things are credited to Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly. They're in the beginning of the Second Temple period. This is all history to them. They're the ones who say, we're going to put this first, maybe Chizkiah and his group, but it's just as good if it's Chizkiah and his group, because again, they're speaking after the times of plenty of Uzziyahu, and after the Assyrians have already come through and leveled the Shomron, right? So it could be that to them, either in Chizkiyahu's day, or in the beginning of the Second Temple day, those are the messages of the Nevi'im of their time. These are the messages that you're going to associate with the Nevi'im at the end of the first Beit HaMikdash. You think of a Yirmiyahu. This, you know, is very comfortable as a Yirmiyahu chapter. You think of Malachi from the beginning of the second Beit HaMikdash, right? The second or third generation of it. These messages are consistent. They're looking at their audience of their day, who are the ones who are going to receive Tanakh. And their descendants, because Tanakh is canonized with an eye toward the future, which is important for all generations. And they say, this is the message we need front and center. For our time, for who's going to read this,
this has to be first. I suspect that that's what's going on, that that's why this this is put first. Yeshaya didn't say it first. It wasn't addressed to Uzziahu and his crowd. They never heard it. It wasn't around. But by the time you get to the canonization of Yeshaya, this becomes the most important message to be conveyed. That's what I think is what's going on. Okay, let's see if we can get to one more point here. We'll have one or two minor things to wrap up next week, but one more major point. The major theme in this chapter is fix your bein adam l'chaveiro. Fix the way that you relate to each other. If you can fix the way you relate to each other, then I'll take you back, God says. Everything else will fall into place. If you take a look on page 900, again, 955, by the time we're done with this chapter, I'm going to know. It's page 955. Chapter 1, sentences 16 to 23. And in the interest of time, we're going to just take a fast look at it in the English. Wash yourselves, purify yourselves, remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes, cease doing evil, do good, seek justice, vindicate the victim, render justice to the orphan, take up the grievance of the widow. And if you do that, he says, if your sins are like scarlet, they'll be white as snow, you have become red as crimson, they'll be white as wool. Everything will be repaired. I will take you back if you heal what you've done to other people. That fits the image of Sodom that he's used here. Right? In chapter 1, sentence 9, the Jews speak and they say, we were like Sodom, we were like Amorah. That's not a statement of guilt. When I first read it, I thought that was a statement of guilt. But it's not. If you look at it in context, sentence 9 is, we are destroyed like Sodom and Amorah. Fitting this week's parsha, by the way. That was neat. They say, we were destroyed like Sodom and Amorah. We are suffering like Sodom and Amorah. To which sentence 10 responds with God saying, aha, because you are Kitsinei Sodom, because you are Amorah, because you acted like Sodom and Amorah, therefore you were destroyed like Sodom and Amorah. There's a Gemara in Brachos, which I didn't bring here in the interest of time, that discusses Al Tiftach Pela Satan. When you say we were destroyed like Sodom, you're just begging for somebody to fill that in for you. Don't say you are like Sodom unless you're prepared to suffer the consequences. But the message of a comparison to Sodom is selfishness and slated for destruction. That's the message there. And God says, through Yeshaya, if you aren't like Sodom anymore, then you won't be destroyed. Stop being like Sodom. Their sin is the sin of harming others, so don't do it. And taken as a unit, these psukim, these sentences tell us that Hashem's priorities emphasize bein adam l'chaveiro, the way you deal with each other, and that it's a major factor in the eventual destruction. Which takes me back to Janine's question from last week, which is, but we are taught that the first temple is destroyed because of, again, Gilui Arayot, Shpichut Damim, Avodah Zarah. First temple is specifically supposed to be sexual immorality. It is supposed to be idolatry. It is supposed to be murder. Now, I did note that two out of three are still social sins in there. But take a look at source number 9 quickly. Source number 9 is the Gemara that is the source for that idea. And when you see the full text, you have your answer. The Gemara says, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to read the English aloud, but you can see the Hebrew as well. Why was the first temple destroyed? Because of three things: idolatry, immorality, and bloodshed. And they quote verses for each one. They then ask, but in the second temple, in the second temple, they were involved in Torah, mitzvot, acts of generosity. Why was it destroyed? Because there was baseless hatred. Note, very important note. Gemilut Chasadim is not inconsistent with Sinat Chinam. People can do acts of generosity and still hate other people baselessly. You know, either because they only give to some people, they don't give to others, or worse, they hate the people they're helping. Unfortunately, both of those exist. Parenthetically. Okay, go on. They ask, they were wicked. There's an earlier text that says that the Jews of the first temple were wicked, but they put their faith in God. This refers to the first temple. What do you mean? The prophet Micha says, their heads judge for bribes, their kohanim rule for a price, their prophets use sorcery for money, and they rely on God, saying, isn't God in our midst? Evil will not befall us. They just assume God's going to protect us. Therefore God brought upon them three decrees for their three sins. And then it asks, but was there not baseless hatred in the first temple? Look at Yechezkel, where he says, "Cry out and wail, son of man. It was upon my nation. It was in all the leaders of Israel. My nation was gathered to the sword. Therefore, strike your thigh." What does that sentence mean? What it means is, Rabbi Elazar said, these are people who eat and drink with each other and stab each other with the swords of their tongues. So the challenge is, I don't understand. If we could explain Ezekiel, Yechezkel, to say that the Jews of that time are eating together and stabbing each other at the same time, then they had this animosity in the first temple too. So the Gemara here answers, this was regarding the leaders of Israel. And he refers you back to hints within the text. In the first temple, it's the leadership. And that's consistent with Yeshaya's message. Yeshaya's message is to the judges. His message is to the Kohanim. His message is to the aristocracy. By the time you're at the second temple, unfortunately, the problem has infected everybody. But in Yeshaya's day, it's the leadership who are corrupt, says this passage of Gemara here, and that's the answer to your question of how we reconcile it. The Maharal brings another answer. He says certain sins may have caused the liability, but other sins actually were the immediate cause of punishment. The Maharal in Bava Metzia Lamed Amud Bet is another good source for this. But again, to sum up what we've accomplished here, we have two minor points that I want to wrap up next week, but we're basically sort of on track. I'm just going to pretend. That's also true. We talked about the heaven and earth as witnesses and the message of either they are partners in our mitzvot, or they are meant to be role models for us, lessons for us, or they are instruments of reward and punishment. We talked about the divine rejection a little bit. We talked about the chronology question and why this is first, and the idea that it's first because it's canonized at a time when this is the critical message, or because it's the themes of the book, the main sins that are going to be identified. And then we saw the importance of ben adam l'chaveiro, of fixing that which is wrong socially. When you sin socially, then you will find the punishments of Sodom brought upon the nation. God willing, we pick up with that next week. There was one hand up. I forget where it was. No? Okay. Then we pick up next week. Please, if you can get a chance to read chapter 2 in advance, it would really help. Thank you very much.